podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to Nessun Dorma, the pod that takes a look down the grid of 80s and 90s football and finds Craig Hignett's hair mousse underneath a pile of David Unsworth's discarded Somoza wrappers. I'm your host, Lee Calvert, and it's been quite a while. It's been about 6 months since the last episode, but we hope the miserable summer of only having modern football to watch and a World Cup at that, and the constant refrain of association football mayhaps returning to its domicile didn't depress you too much as you're trying to get through the summer. But never fear, because we're here to shake you from your contemporary slumber and transport you back to a simpler time, a time that reeked of dupe aftershave and echoed to the sound of Wannabe by the Spice Girls, and when you look back now, a mystifying overconfidence about being British. That's right, it's 1996, and joining me to take a look back at this fevered time is author of a book about this very year called When Football Came Home, and a fine one it is too, Mr. Mike Gibbons.
Hi, Lee. How you doing?
Good, good, good. And squeezing time for us in between theatre reviews and being generally eloquent about cricket is the Scouse Oracle himself, Mr. Gary Naylor. Hello, Gary.
It's lovely to be back.
Yes, it is. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, there is a Twitter account, at Nessun Dorma Pod, a website, nessundormapod.com, and there's mailing lists, and you can email contact at nessundormapod.com if you want to get in touch on the email and all that kind of stuff. We're available on Acast, and we're available on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, I think it's called now. So, you know, tell your friends, and hopefully you're glad to have us back, and we're certainly very glad to have you back. Thank you very much, and thank you for your patience. So while the current season may be about a month old now, I think, roughly that, isn't it? We're taking this as our opening weekend, and so this episode will take a look at the opening weekend of the 1996-97 season, which could be argued as the most 90s season of seasons. The games for this opening season, this opening weekend of that season, were played on the 17th of August 1996, and I think one on the Sunday, and then was it Monday night football then? Can anyone remember? Was it a Monday night game?
I think it's very likely, because I remember Monday night football with Ebenezer Good. Who was the band that did Ebenezer Good? They were on the pitch at Crystal Palace. And that must have been 92 or 93.
Yeah, so they haven't thrown it
I would
out
imagine
then,
yeah.
Yeah, so whoever's some games on Monday as well. Now, I've already mentioned at this time that Wannabe by the Spice Girls was number one on the 17th of August. It was that whole summer. Before that, the number one was Forever Love by Gary Barlow. And following Wannabe, was the number one was Flavour by Peter Andre. Now, that is one trifecta of bloody awful right there, isn't it?
I'll tell you what I don't want, what I really don't want, it's that.
So, before we get into the details, what were you fellas up to in the summer of 1996? Gary, what were you doing? Were you still in fashion then, or had you moved on?
I was standing up in front of students and teaching a little bit, and I was also doing a lot of union work at that time. But the week before that started the season, I was at Nebworth for Oasis.
Well, of course, that was the summer, wasn't it? Yes.
Yeah. It was a long day, I remember. And the Chemical Brothers were the main support, and I don't think I was quite in the Chemical Brothers hitting zone when it comes to their
drum loops. Not a thing for you, Gary. No, I'm into drum loops.
Yeah, and it was a very long day, and I remember riding the motorbike back and thinking I'm kind of glad it's over, really. But the other thing I was doing is rather given away by the fact that my my first son was born at the end of May 1997, so make of that what you will.
And that was the last time that you even bothered, yeah. What about you, Mike? What were you up to in August 1996?
Well, I just worked this out today, actually. 2 days before this set of fixtures, I got my A-level results and found out that I'd be going to university in October that year. So I'll probably be incredibly hungover still on this Saturday, I'd imagine. Yeah, that whole summer was a very football-orientated summer. My A-levels actually finished. I did my last A-level the day after England beat Holland 4-1. So that was something of a distraction. Fortunately, though, I was doing the A-level of media studies, which is, you know, the whipping boy of A-level subjects.
And my school didn't even offer that. So
yeah. So the whole summer was just this kind of hinterland between school and university, really. And I did, you know, a lot of mid-90s stereotype things. I went to Ibiza for 2 weeks. I think all of the week leading up to these fixtures, I would have been listening to the Nebworth gig, which I'd taped off the radio.
Yeah, I was a big Oasis fan at the time. If you want to talk, we're not going to talk about U96. We'll touch on it a little bit. But if you want a full breakdown of U96, you need to go back to Series 1, Episode 12, back in the archive there. And that'll give you a full breakdown of U96 if you want to remember that a little bit more. In terms of what was I up to in this August 1996? I had just failed my second year at university through excessive going to the pub with a gang of my friends. And was about to resit my second year in the midst of all of that. And that was it. I was working in a factory which made soft furnishings for Marks and Spencer. And everything was done with it, you know, like an air-powered staple gun. And what was really funny was that the guys who worked on the line used to, when they'd hit their bonus target for the furniture, they would shoot themselves through the top of the finger with a staple so they could just go home. And I was working there as a labourer, and I was stood there one day, and I said, I can't be arsed with this today. And Big Nigel, who worked at the top of the line, says to me, do you want me to shoot you? And I went, no, you're all right, Nigel. I'm just a bit pissed off. I don't want you to maim me so I can go home, basically. So that's what life in a factory was like for me.
Yeah. Sounds like the trenches at Passchendaele. That's what they did there.
It's like, no, sorry, we've got a break in an hour. You don't have to, you know, I don't need to be invalided back to Blighty. It's fine, you know.
Did you get to recline on the sofas that you were staying?
You could go into
together?
The foam room, and there was a little, somebody had built on the top shelf of the foam room a little bed for people who were a bit hungover and stuff, and you could go and skive in there for 10 minutes at a time. You used to have that as well. Yeah, so I was second year of uni, so I was a bit older than you, Mike, I think. But yeah, so I was 20 in August 1996.
I was 6 years into teaching in a university. God, dear me, I'm so old.
Right, enough of this. If you wanted to watch something other than football, by the way, this weekend, you could watch on BBC Two. They had three Orson Welles films back to back.
Ooh, can we guess them?
It's, well, it'd be here all day. We've got Macbeth.
Well, Citizen Kane, Touch of Evil, and The Trial.
No, it was Macbeth, Jane Eyre, and Ferry to Hong Kong.
Dear me, that's very much in the B League for Orson Welles.
It is very much in the B League. This is on BBC Two, followed by The Proms, then followed by Dancing in the Street, a rock and roll history documentary. If you wanted to watch BBC One, of course, Grandstand was still on in 1996, which we all miss. Best theme tune ever, possibly. Ray Stubbs hosting, featuring today football focus, cricket focus. They don't do that anymore, do they? They gave up on cricket focus. Show Jumping, featuring the Derby meeting from Hickstead.
Oh, the famous bank and the Devil's Dyke.
Really? I know nothing about show jumping.
Absolutely.
I have no desire to know anything about show jumping either. Racing from Newbury, the world's shittest sport. golf coverage. People always said up there, I like going to the races, but he said, no, you don't like going to the races. You like drinking near horses. That's what you like doing. If they allowed you to get pissed at the zoo, you'd go to the zoo and do it. You wouldn't go to the races. But yeah. Golf coverage from Woburn. And then followed by Coneheads, the terrible Dan Aykroyd film. Due South, about the bloke who was the Mountie who came to America, culture clash comedy. And of course, Casualty, which is still going on now. And then Match of the Day. So speaking of Match of the Day, let's cover the things that were actually happening in football. So this was, we mentioned before, Mike, this is off the back of Euro 96. So what's the mood music like in sort of England and English football?
Well, for this coming season, I mean, the anticipation I remember being huge for 1996, 97. I mean, a lot of that, you know, it's off the back of Euro 96. So you have the big spike of, you know, interest generally across the country. And I think what helped was the season before had been one of the Premier League's greatest seasons, I guess. I loathe to use the word narrative, but it had all these stories running through it. You know, you can't win with kids. Mm. Cantona coming back from his ban and scoring all the goals that won the league, the sort of doomed romanticism of Newcastle, the White Suit Cup final. And you also had contained the greatest, probably the greatest Premier League game, the 4-3, you know, with Newcastle and Liverpool. And I think you can draw a line back from, you know, all the hype about the Premier League being the best league in the world, probably back to that game and that season. I mean, that game wasn't a hype job. It was an amazing game, but it's kind of an indication of where I think the coverage of the Premier League would go afterwards. There was a line from it by Roy Evans. He said, called it kamikaze football. Mm. He's saying, oh, we're leaving play, you know, the defenders 2-on-2, 3-on-3, and they're up against the greatest strikers in the world. And I remember hearing that and thinking, what, the greatest strikers in the world, you know, for Newcastle, Liverpool. But it's but then the Premier League, thereafter, the Premier League did start to be, you know, spoken about in those kind of terms. And I mean, a big part of that was all the players that were coming in. So the year before this season, you had two big things happen to facilitate this. I've mentioned this on the pod before, but I'll mention it again in lieu of anything else interesting I've got to say. But so the Bosman ruling was passed in December 1995. So that changed the rules completely about, you know, the amount of EU national players you could play. And also the Premier League, they re-signed the TV deal in April of 1996. So all of a sudden you had all the clubs in the Premier League with all this cash on the hip and now the opportunity to go in and bid for players all over the world, basically. And
they did.
They did, yeah.
So you mentioned the signings there. Obviously, this is remembered as the kind of summer of mega signings. When you look back at, I mean, there were some good signings, don't get me wrong, but when you look at the list of sort of what was considered to be the big signings back then, of which some of them were big, you had Roberto from America, we're looking at it now, you had Roberto Di Matteo and LeBouf and Viali all went to Chelsea. I think Viali went on a free, didn't he? When you speak of Bosman, did he go on a free, Viali?
Yeah, he was free after the European Cup final. Yeah.
That's right, yeah. Who were pretty big. LeBouf had won a World Cup, of course, but or was going to head towards winning a World Cup, but he never convinced me greatly, Frank LeBouf.
No, he was in the France squad at Euro 96, but he didn't get anywhere near the pitch, I don't think. They had Blanc and Desailly, and no one had really seen him. Really,
in 1999, he had no idea how to deal with the mighty Ian Marshall, who came off the bench for Leicester and terrorised him. Before Steve Guppy scored to basically take the title away from Chelsea that year. You had the two big signings at Middlesbrough, Fabrizio Ravanelli and Emerson. And I think what a lot of people maybe don't remember, or they do remember, but I certainly didn't remember, is that Juninho was already there. In my sort of memory, if you ask me, I said Juninho came in the summer of 96. He didn't, he came in 95, so he'd already been there a year.
Yeah, that was a bit of a game changer for me, because the idea of Juventus and Italy centre forward turning out for Middlesbrough was just like two or three years earlier, but 10 years earlier, it was just completely inconceivable. And you know, that showed that the Premier League was, I mean, I'm tempted to say the word serious. It was serious, but there was such volume of money coming through. I mean, it looks like tuppence halfpenny now, but at the time, it was literally incredible. And I remember seeing that Middlesbrough side, and Emerson, who's probably the forgotten one of that trio, he played as a kind of very deep-lying midfielder. He may even have played in the back four. And he was
a Makalele before a Makalele.
Yeah, he was playing a different game to everybody else on the pitch at Goodison. The amount of time he had, the amount of technical ability to kill a ball, to take it on the half turn. He might as well have been from another planet. And he kind of disappeared, I think, although somebody will tell me he had a remarkable career in Finland or something afterwards. But he was absolutely brilliant that day. And what I felt about 96, and you can see it when you look at those highlights, is you could almost see the game changing before your eyes as the players become much more technical. The long balls going out of the game, but the idea of, say, taking the ball on the half turn, every player expected to be comfortable in possession. The harem scarem stuff was disappearing. The old Wimbledon approach, who was it, you'll know, Lee, Charles, somebody or other at the FA who wrote that coaching manual, who said, you know, got to get it in the mix of the
The long ball guy, maximum
opportunity. Charles Hughes, it was. And that was disappearing out of the game. It was partly that the foreign players were coming in who the cliche has it were better technicians, but they were obviously better technicians. But there's one other thing that you see, I think, as a kind of turning point in 96-97. It becomes recognised when Wenger goes to Arsenal in the autumn of that season. The players stop looking like blokes on the terraces. They stop looking like sort of average 20-something blokes carrying a little bit of weight and 5'10", 5'11", something like that. And we started to see the effect of dietitians. We started to see the effect of the gym work. And we started to see players who looked very different to the people on the terraces. Some of that was through the Wenger revolution that was at Arsenal, but it started before then as well. Players got bigger, they got stronger, and they started to move further and further away from the kind of park footballers that you still saw in the early 90s coming through. You know, obviously the greatest of them all was Gazza, and sometimes we look back at Gazza with such nostalgia because he was a kind of street footballer who came through. Maybe people would say Rooney was one as well, but they were disappearing, and sometimes in matches in 96 you could see the changing of the guard.
Yeah, and I think there was, but even as, I mean, I remember thinking as probably still now, really, I'm always still amazed that, you know, kids in this country now, when they come through from schoolboy, are in an academy from the age of about 9 now, aren't they? And yeah, why is it, for example, we still produce so many players who can't use both feet? It absolutely staggers me that you can come through an academy and you got people who can't use whichever foot is not their most dominant foot. And why do we still, I'm not going to do this too much because it's about now, but you mentioned that point about, you know, foreign coaches came in, foreign players came in, brought in more technical ability, people could see more technical ability. It's interesting that we still, and by we I mean England and the Premier League and the academies, still don't produce a great number of technicians, do they?
Well, my answer to that is one that I've probably made before at some point on this pod, is that, and it was definitely the case in the 90s, is that our players used to train and not practice. And I remember hearing about Beckham, and they said it's remarkable with Beckham because at 1 o'clock, when all the other players go home, he stays behind and he practices free kicks like he was some kind of man from Mars. Whereas in every other sport, you practice the techniques. But in England, we trained. You know, there were stories, weren't there, of Jock Wallace's famous hill at Leicester, where he had them running up and down sandbanks. The first 3 weeks of the season, the players aren't allowed to touch the ball and all of this kind of stuff. That was still the ethos at that time. Right. And I think, to some extent, we're still paying for it now. In every other sport you practice, there is no excuse whatsoever then and now for a corner being taken and hitting the first man. It kicks a dead ball. It's like throwing a dart at a dartboard and missing the board. It doesn't happen in darts. It shouldn't happen in football.
Any views on that, Mike?
Well, I mean, yeah, that was definitely still the case in the 90s, wasn't it? And I think, well, it's changed now with the whole St. George's Park, and you've got all those kind of young lads who won the youth tournaments in 2017. But yeah, I think this season we're going to come on to talk about. I think there was a definite change in emphasis after this. I mean, Wenger is a big part of that. The change in diet particularly, he's always credited with.
Yeah, you mentioned Emerson there, Gary, but of course you have to remember that the counterfoil to Emerson in that Borough midfield was Robbie Musto. Yes. It's all very well having this lad who can play on the half turn. What you need is a lad from Middlesbrough who can just basically run up and down in straight lines a lot. So going back to the signings, it was Emerson, he came in.
And you said people. Don't forget, Lee, he could kick people.
He could kick people. Jamie Pollock as well, I think, was coming through at Middlesbrough at this time.
Oh,
You mentioned about Emerson disappearing. He literally disappeared. He didn't come back from Brazil when he went home for Christmas, I think. Was that this season? I think it was. And I was in Middlesbrough University at this time. And the buzz around the town was remarkable. And we'll probably talk about this later. But, of course, they were docked 3 points this season, which is what, you know, you could argue effectively got them relegated. But we'll come on to that later on when we kind of conclude what happens after this first weekend. Who else came in? Patrick Berger. It's post 96, Euro 96. Patrick Berger came in to Liverpool.
Wearing Tommy Fleetwood's hair, if I recall.
Yes. So it's a, sorry, I've just knocked a drink over. And some unknown midfielder called Patrick Vieira came in. I wonder whatever happened to him.
Yeah, well, he was signed before Wenger got to the club, actually. So in the week leading up to this first round of fixtures, Bruce Rioch was sacked by Arsenal. It took them a while. I think it was about a month later that Wenger was announced. The favourite for the job was actually Johan Cruyff, but it went to Wenger, who was, you know, a complete unknown. But before he arrived, they signed Patrick Vieira and Remy Gard. So there's a little indication of what, for people who were in, I guess, in the know with French football.
I remember when Wenger was announced, and it was on the news, and it was a newsreader, and she was a female newsreader. That was not relevant, because I remember, because that's the vision, the image is in my head. And he was so unknown, they didn't know how to say his name. And she said, Arsenal have appointed the manager Arsène Wenger, because obviously they thought, oh, he's French, that must be how you pronounce him. But of course, he's from Alsace, isn't he, and all that stuff. So, they didn't even know how to pronounce his name. I do remember that, Gary.
One of the things that was also important in terms of that Rioch side is that Arsenal, one could argue, had the two of the most technically gifted players were already there in Dennis Bergkamp and Paul Merson. And, Merson's become something of a figure of fun now, but he was a fantastic footballer, way ahead of his time for an English player. And, of course, we all know about the off-field activities, but on the field, he was as technically gifted as any English player, arguably before or since. So the nucleus of a side was there, waiting for the Wenger revolution to come. I remember my father saying about Wenger, because there was some concern. You know, he was this professorial figure who'd only played at the fourth level in France, and he was coming from Japan, wasn't he, across here? And you know, the proper football men, as John Nicholson calls them on Football 365, were rubbishing him before he had a chance. I remember my dad saying, "Why? What have they got against this bloke? Why won't they give him a chance?" And then, of course, within about 2 weeks, we realised that we were dealing with a substantive figure who was likely to be a major figure in British football. And just a little nod in the direction of a guy who perhaps doesn't get the credit he deserves, which is David Dean, because he was Arsenal chairman at the time, and he went out on a limb and got Wenger because he believed in him. And, Dean gets a bit of a mixed press now, but, his time at Arsenal was one of innovation and one of a deep commitment to a really kind of new way of running a football club and a new way of playing the game on the field.
So, yeah, there's Vieira comes into Arsenal. We'll talk about Arsenal. We'll talk about the games in a minute. But the legendary Karol Poborski signing, we covered that when we did Great Tournament, Bad Signing, which was back in episode 4 of season 1, if you want to go back and have a look at that. Who had 22 minutes on the sweep of when Gary's going to tell us what his dad thought of something? I'd love to have met your dad, Gary. Genuinely, he sounds like he'd be the best person in the world to talk to for an afternoon.
You may not have said that at the end of the afternoon, but I know what you mean.
Poborski goes to United. We've covered that before. We don't need to go into that again. Benito Carboni went to Sheffield Wednesday. I think, you know, I remember it all being very exciting because he was called Benito Carboni. Obviously, when you look back, he wasn't exactly a rip-roaring player, Carboni, but he did seem to be exciting because of his name. Alan Shearer.
When he was good, he was very good, Carboni.
Ended up at Bradford after this, didn't he, after Sheffield Wednesday?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there was a few of them did the rounds of some of the kind of northern sides, but I thought when he was good, he was very good. He was a bit of a poor man's Di Canio, but you know, he can be a poor man's Di Canio and still be pretty good, I think.
Of course, the big marquee signing this summer was Shearer, Mike. That's right, isn't it? It's this summer.
Yeah, that was 15 million. Yeah, that went through, I think, about a week and a half before the opening round of fixtures. So there was a big debate all summer after Bureau 96. Was he going to sign for Manchester or Newcastle United? Beckham and Gary Neville actually met him. I think it was backstage at a Bryan Adams concert.
Oof.
And they tried to talk him out of going to Newcastle. But so his heart was set on it, and his unveiling was covered live on Sky News. I remember that quite vividly. And
that was all. This was the precursor to transfer deadline day madness. Now, wasn't it? Really, that was the seed sown. Again, when you talk about drawing the line between something happens then and what happens now,
and the fee as well. I mean, it was, I think the transfer record in Britain before this had been 8.5 million. I think it was Colley Moore to Liverpool, and this didn't just shatter the British record; it broke the world record at the time as well. So just a little kind of indication of how much money was coming into the game.
And again, if you want to find out more about world transfer records through time, then you can go listen to episodes 13 and 14. Or episode 13, part 1 and part 2, where we do go through that list. Yeah, so it was quite a big deal that he signed. Of course, I do feel, though, that the signing of Alan Shearer did somewhat overshadow another signing that summer that Newcastle made, which was Steve Harper. He went on to make about 1.243 million bench appearances for Newcastle before retiring in 2017 at the age of 76. He was basically the perennial sub-goalkeeper behind any number of people. I think he was behind Shaka Hislop for years, Shay Given. He just sat there.
Who was a Czech lad who died, unfortunately? Oh, Pavel Cernicek. Yeah, he was behind him as well, I think.
So Steve Harper again. But that's when he was signed. He must have been about 12 when he signed, because he was there forever. That's a run through the kind of biggish ones. Interestingly, when I was looking through as well, Ian Rush signed for Leeds this summer on a free, because Liverpool had finally let him go. Also signed for Leeds this summer, which again amazed me when I looked back on it, was Mark Hatley.
Yeah, well, I think that was a free transfer to cover they had a bit of an injury crisis at the start of the season. Hmm. So it was Howard Wilkinson's last hurrah. I think he got sacked quite early into that season. That summer,
it was after the United loss, wasn't it? They flirted him.
Yes, that was it. Yeah, and that summer he'd kind of gutted the Leeds midfield. He'd sold Gary McAllister. He sold Gary Speed. He brought in Lee Sharp. I think he equaled the Leeds transfer record to bring Lee Sharp across from United.
He signed Lee Bowyer from Charlton as well.
Yes, he did. He would have been 18
in full shithouse mode then when he was 18. But yeah, so he signed in. Again, the way the mind plays tricks on you, you forget that this was still Wilkinson. In my mind, I couldn't remember if it was Graham or were we in the O'Leary period by this phase. And actually, no, it was still Wilkinson. Any listeners out there, if you haven't seen it, if you're an Amazon Prime member, there's actually a documentary called, I don't know if you two have watched it, called Do You Want to Win? Which is about Wilkinson and Wilkinson's takeover of Leeds. The biggest surprise for me is how well Vinnie Jones comes out of it. Comes out of it incredibly well. And a guy we talked about on the pod a few weeks ago is all over it as well. If you remember us talking about Mr. Cess Pod.
Oh, yeah.
Well, he's on in it because he was Leeds' community relations guy in the late 80s, which must have been a hell of a job, by the way, trying to turn that squad upside down.
One of the differences that we find is that Leeds, Mike will know this, correct me, Mike, was it 91 or 92 that Leeds won the last of the old first divisions?
91-92, yeah, just before the Premier League started. Yeah.
So the next season after that was famously, I think, the worst defence of a title or something. I think they won one away game and finished about 12th or something like that. But back in those days, the start of the 96 season, a manager who'd won a title in 92 was still living off that and was still widely respected, and there was not this kind of Pochettino's lost three games in a row, let's sack him. because of course the social media wasn't there, the endless phone-ins wasn't there, the 24/7 sports media weren't there, and so you could, as a manager, live on your laurels for not just for a week or two, but you could live for a year or two on your laurels. And Leeds were sort of going nowhere. They were soon to get embroiled, I think, in all kinds of financial shenanigans when they were selling essentially futures, weren't they, on their stands and season tickets. And they, was it Peter Ridsdale going for broke, trying to win the European Cup
They basically mortgaged everything on being in the Champions League every year for the next 10 years, and it's really not as easy as that, is it?
No, they did get to the semi-final though. So,
well, I think that's what gave him this confidence to basically effectively go long on that strategy, which was
That's it. But when you compare the sort of panic that takes over, certainly fans and media, if you get sort of three losses in a row, they were perhaps simpler, perhaps gentler, perhaps better days then, where management and football realised that not everybody can win everything, and therefore sometimes you've got to stick with the guy because he's the best option. That said, I couldn't wait for Everton to get rid of Walter Smith, and that's another one.
Last couple of things on signings. Mike, United signed Ole Gunnar Solskjaer this summer.
Who?
Did he score any important goals? Now, you're a United fan. So, Fergie made a lot of decent signings. Where does Solskjaer rank for you?
Oh, blimey. I mean, he'd definitely have to get in a top five. Maybe even in a top three.
Cantona's a top, obviously.
It's just incredible how it worked out, really. So he came in that summer of 96. He was one of a group of five signings with Ronnie Johnson, Van der Hau, Poborski and Cruyff that we've already mentioned. So he didn't come into the club with any kind of great fanfare. But then in his first season, the 96-97 season, I think he scored 18 Premier League goals. And his kind of United career is remembered as being, you know, this impact substitute. But he started a lot more games for United than I think people realise. He scored, I think, something like 150 goals. You know, the one we all remember, the Bayern one in the Camp Nou. I mean, you talk about dining out for the rest of your life. I mean, he'll never have to buy a drink in the Red Half of Manchester again, obviously. But beyond that, I mean, we haven't got time for me to name all the kind of crucial contributions and goals that he scored in games for United. It's just.
And I kind of guess you were going to say that. That's why I kind of led you into it. I think a lot of people still do have this image of him as being this super sub who just was brought on for the last 20 minutes when actually he was a far better footballer than that, Gary.
Yeah, well, he was brought on for the last 20 minutes and scored four against Everton. I remember that. I was in Oslo. I think at the time that he signed for Manchester United, and I remember seeing his face on the back of the papers because, of course, he never saw any of these foreign players. There was no online news, and telly didn't really cover it or anything. And he looked about 14. He really did. There was not a football fan, or indeed a non-football fan in Oslo, who didn't think he was a fantastic player and that Manchester United were getting a real star. And so it appeared. It appeared to be. I think he's one of the most underrated players of that decade. And now his worth would be sort of astronomical. Because boy, did he make a difference in the games that he played, not just as a substitute, but as a starter too.
We spend quite a bit of time on this podcast, I think, making the point that there was no internet in the period that we're talking about, but it's quite relevant to the impact that someone like Solskjaer would have had, and not just Solskjaer, but, you know, Georgi Kinkladze and, you know, Tony Yeboah and these kind of people. There are signings that, you know, you'd never heard of. You might have, if you read World Soccer, kind of picked up a bit about them, but, you know, there was no YouTube montage of their goals for, you know, the Norwegian side that they played for or anything like that. And I think, that kind of mystique of the signings of that summer, I mean, some were dreadful flops, obviously, but I mean, some, the ones that were hits, the ones that came out of nowhere, were just, it's hard to emphasize now what a kind of thrill that is. Now you kind of, you know, everything about a player you sign, and you can find it out instantly as well. You can just go to YouTube and get it.
Last thing on signings, Tottenham did not have a great. They actually won this opening weekend, but didn't have a great season. And in a way, I think a lot of that was one indicated by what happened in the opening game, and we'll talk about that in a minute if you don't remember what it is, ladies and gentlemen. But also, it's indicated by the only signing that they made, that Jerry Francis, the man who's had the same haircut since 1975. You really can't trust that in a person, to be honest. The only signing Tottenham made was Jason Cundy. He now of TalkSport, talking utter bollocks. Fame. But it says a lot. I mean, you look at Tottenham now, when you look at, and the kind of, is it fair to say a tragedy of Tottenham? But there is something tragicomic about Tottenham, certainly through this period, I think. And it's kind of summed up by the only signing that Jerry Francis thought he needed at this point was Jason Cundy. Now then, let's move on to the actual games of the opening weekend of August the 17th, 1996-97. We'll just go in alphabetical order because it makes sense that way. We've already talked about Arsenal. They won 2-0 at West Ham with goals from John Hartson and a penalty from Dennis Bergkamp in front of 38,000 people at Highbury. We've already mentioned this was Arsene Wenger's first season in charge. A fairly solid win for them, albeit Steve Jones, who was playing up front, who I had no memory of whatsoever playing up front for West Ham, missed an absolute howler when David Seaman kicked the ball straight at him.
Well, I remember him winning the London Marathon, but I don't remember him playing for West Ham.
Well, he's the scout. Isn't he a scouser? Steve Jones, a runner. Isn't he from Liverpool?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
Isn't he the one who ran so quick in that marathon? In which Olympics was it where he went out so quick in the marathon that he was like literally walking and looked like a hollowed out shell of a man in the last 10 minutes?
It's probably 84 or 88.
I think it was 88, yeah. But what's interesting about Arsenal, you talked about signings, right? But when you look at this first season of Wenger and you look at who left between Christmas, well, between Wenger coming in at the end of that season, here's a list of the people who Wenger thought were no longer useful to him. Gavin McGowan, Steve Morrow, John Hartson, Andy Linnigan, Chris Kawamya, Glenn Helder, Ian Selly, I think he might have gone on loan actually, David Hillier, Eddie McGoldrick and Paul Dickov.
Yeah, not many of them could take a ball on the half turn, could they?
It's like he must have phoned up the donkey sanctuary and said, could you bring your van down? And basically, because I've got a few that you need to pick up sort of thing. It's, but you know, you can just imagine Arsene casting his eye over the training ground, can't you, in his first few weeks and going, what the fucking hell is that lot?
There's an awful lot of forwards in there. How many excess centre forwards did Arsenal have at that point?
Yeah, who's a forward there? Hartson, Kawamya,
Dickov.
Yeah.
Well, you got to remember that with Hartson, he was either suspended or injured for two games out of three. So
he scored a brilliant Hartson-esque goal in this game. He just kind of come flying in and dived across the 6-yard box and somehow managed to get it in there. So that was the Arsenal game. Anything do you want to say on anything else on that Arsenal game, Mike?
They're in that weird period of stasis, weren't they? I think the Reok sacking, I think it was literally 4 days before these games. So
yeah, and Wenger came in, yeah, just as the season was starting, effectively. Yeah. Didn't he?
And to think that they've only had two full-time managers since then is it's quite
it rather bucks the trend, shall we say? Doesn't
it really does. Yeah.
The aforementioned terrible Tottenham played Blackburn Rovers at Ewood Park. They won 2-0, two goals from Chris Armstrong. He was spearheading their attack at that time.
I remember Chris Armstrong a couple of years later scoring a hat-trick at White Hart Lane against Everton. I think he was the kind of player who did score.
The only memories you have involve people shaming Everton, basically.
Yeah, I was there. It was an awful long walk back to the Seven Sisters tube station, I can tell you. It's never a pleasant walk, but on the 28th of December, after seeing a Chris Armstrong hat-trick, he was an interesting player in lots of ways, because you get the idea that if he had coaching that's available today, he would be much better, because he had a lot of what he looked for in a forward. Yeah. You know, he was quick. He had an eye for goal.
He could go both ways on his feet. Yeah.
I mean, if people are wondering what kind of player he was a little bit like a kind of Wilfred Zaha. He played wide and came inside. He could be a little fragile, I think, but, he had it in him to be a better player than he was. And
perfect, you know, for Tottenham, then, wasn't he, basically?
Well, you know, come on, lads, it's Tottenham, you know?
Yeah, so we've already mentioned the mediocre start for Tottenham season with the Jason Kundi signing. Then on top of that, then, I think you brought it up. What happened to Gary Mabbutt, Mike?
Oh, God, this was horrible, yeah. So Graham Fenton of Blackburn sort of slid across Mabbutt as he was wellying a ball down the line with his left foot and broke Gary Mabbutt's leg. At this point, Gary Mabbutt's 35 years old. And, yeah, poor Gary Mabbutt. I mean, he's so shit out of luck, this bloke. He played his whole career with diabetes. He had his face caved in by John Fashanu with a horrific challenge. He never went to a major tournament with England. He scored a own goal that decided an FA Cup final. It's like, how unlucky can one guy be? And he seems like such a nice bloke as well that you just don't want all this tragedy to befall.
And his kind of bad luck is summed up because when you watch it, it wasn't the tackle that did it. I know it sounds stupid, but actually what happens, Mabbutt cleared the ball and followed through and kind of booted Graham Fenton. I know Fenton was flying in, but it wasn't like a standing leg job. And no, he kind of booted Fenton and smashed his own leg into like 56,000 pieces, basically, the poor fella.
Well, it would probably be a straight red card now.
Oh, I think it would be. I'm not saying it was a good tackle. I'm just saying, you know.
Yeah. But I think everyone did that tackle then, you know, several times a game. It didn't often result in something as horrific as that.
No, he was like the Fast Show's unlucky Alf or something, wasn't he, Gary Mabbutt? Picked up the paper on a Sunday morning and read that he's out for 3 months because
he's from the West Country, not Yorkshire.
Yeah, fallen over while making the toss or something before the game started. We shouldn't make fun because they were horrendous injuries.
They were
not his fault. They were very clearly the fault of others. I mean, that as Mike says, that's the kind of tackle that was done sort of all the time and nobody thought anything of it. Nobody would have dreamt of even a yellow card back then. But on modern definitions of being out of control and endangering your opponent, then it's a red. And look, the game is better for it. I am not someone, even though I'm kind of the oldest and the most nostalgic and everything else, I am not someone who thinks the game was better for the hard men being able to get away with anything short of murder. The game is much, much better for the refereeing as we see it today.
Moving on to Highfield Road, where Coventry City were losing 3-0 to Nottingham Forest in front of 19,500 people, and it was three goals by Super Kevin Campbell. Kevin Campbell was born in Lambeth in 1970. He was a striker. He joined Arsenal in 1985 as a schoolboy, once scoring 59 goals in one season for the academy before making his first team debut in 1988. He hung around for quite a few years, scoring 46 goals in 226 appearances before being offloaded by Rioch in 1996. And signed by Frank Clark at Forest for $2.5 million, and this is where we find him here in this opening game, banging in a lovely hat trick.
Well, he was an Everton hero, of course. He wasn't there at that time. He arrived, I think, towards the end of the 98-99 season,
March
and scored
1999. He signed for Everton. Yeah,
on either there or thereabouts on what was then deadline day, and you know, he came after a row about racism in Turkey, and you know, he came to a club whose record on racism was not good, but he was very quickly embraced by the fans, and he embraced Everton and still speaks very well of his time at Everton.
Well, he basically kept me up, Gary, so they should have embraced him.
He did keep us up. And he also took a box at the ground. There were only eight boxes at Goodison. The stand was built in 1970, the last of the non-cantilevered stands. And he had a box there that he paid for out of his own pocket. I think that was after he'd left Everton. And he very much respected and loved. And one of the things about Kevin Campbell is that he was much more of a technician than we ever thought was going to be the case. And you can see that in that hat trick. His control is good. He looks like the kind of player who would thrive today. And you kind of have the idea that at Arsenal he was a bit of a battering ram. Because he had the kind of build of a light heavyweight and he was young and a bit raw. But from his middle 20s onwards, Kevin Campbell was a very fine player. And as I understand, I don't know whether this record still holds, but for a long time, his 82 goals in a top flight of or in the Premier League, where he played four seasons out of the Premier League, and indeed I think he started in the old First Division, but his 82 goals made him the leading scorer in the Premier League who never got an England cap. And in typical All right. Kevin Campbell style, he's not bitter about this. He just recognises it was a time when there were lots of options for the England manager up front. You know, Shearer, Sheringham, Robbie Fowler, probably plenty of others. Matt Letizia only got a handful of caps, of 10, I think. So he understands that. And he is such a decent bloke. And whenever I see him doing the bits of media work that he does now,
So, Mike, as Gary said, it was a lovely hat-trick, this, isn't it? It's got everything in it, really.
Yeah, it's three superb goals. I mean, the first one is it the first one where he kind of he's played through and he slides in. He knows he's going to get clattered by the goalkeeper, and they just smash into each other and he dinks one. But the third one is the one it's the kind of goal you score when you've already scored two goals and your confidence is flying. He takes down a header from a long ball, fakes to shoot, chips it into the area, and then just kind of drills it in with his left foot. I mean, I'd take the point what Gary was saying about, you know, there were other good England strikers around at the time while he was playing. But if you look back at how good he was, particularly in the early 90s, I mean, in the 1991 season, he came into the Arsenal team when Alan Smith was injured and scored a load of goals in like February and March, I think, to help win them that title. He was in the starting team that won the Cup Winners' Cup, the FA Cup, the League Cup, all under Graham. I mean, if you think of some of the players that Graham Taylor was playing around then up front, in comparison to Kevin Campbell, it's amazing. I don't think he even made a squad either. I don't even think you know, he's ever called up and even looked at on that basis, which
seems extraordinary. Yeah, I think he was one of those players that was always seen as that one rung below, wasn't he? And once that kind of gets stuck, it really stays stuck.
Yeah.
In the mind of like, you know, people who make these selections.
Yeah, and he was kind of in Ian Wright's shadow a little bit as well when Ian Wright went to Arsenal. But one quick thing about him, actually, towards the end of his career, and this will sort of nail him back to the mid-90s, he started a record label.
Yes, he did, didn't he? Yeah.
Thinking about 2005, and his first signing was Mark Morrison of Return of the Mac mid-90s fame.
So he made a few bob off that, I imagine, because it sold a few, it shifted a few, Return of the Mac, didn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think he signed him well after that. So
I see, right, okay.
And I think it ended up in court as well, being dragged through court, the horrible fall.
Oh, that sounds more like it.
Yeah.
So again, at the end of the season, Forest were relegated again for the second time after 92, was it, they were relegated? 93, 92, can't remember.
92, 93, yeah, club's last season. Yeah.
Campbell scored 22 goals in the the championship by then, to help them return as champions from that division. He then sodded off, as you mentioned before, Gary, to Trabzonspor, and then left when the president called him a cannibal in a racially motivated tirade. The fans loved him though, and actually, in his press conference where he was saying that he was leaving, he was actually flanked by the club captain and one of the leading players of the club as well. They supported him all the way. So it seems that he then, obviously, you've mentioned he went to Everton. Effectively saved them from relegation in 99. I think he's still the fourth top scorer in Everton's history still. And then after that went to West Brom and then slowly kind of drifted away. But again, it kind of backs up. It seems everywhere he went, he was liked.
Yeah, I think that's true. And he had an off-field life in which, you know, he did his music, but he did more than just music. He put his money where his mouth was, and unfortunately I think he was involved with Mark Morrison, who doesn't have a particularly good reputation, but he was working with the kind of lads with whom he grew up on the council estate in Lambeth, and helping them in their careers. So, you know, like lots of Everton fans, I won't have a word said against him.
Speaking of Everton, we head to Goodison Park now, where Alan Shearer's Newcastle and the great Keegan machine comes rolling in to one side of Stanley Park, Gary, and soundly loses.
Yeah, it was nice to start the season with a win in glorious sunshine. And what we can see on the headlights, I think they were caught like a rabbit in the headlights, because Duncan Ferguson was at his most chaotically destructive. He did have matches, and you know, the kind of looking back with rose-tinted spectacles, these matches came every couple of weeks, but in reality, they were far less frequent than that. But he did have matches where he was just completely unplayable and you just couldn't do anything with him. And teams did get wise to that and just let him head the ball, didn't challenge him, and tried to pick up the second ball. But those highlights, you can see just what a handful he was. And of course, Newcastle, not long after that, were to make him the highest paid player in England when he was signed on a weekly wage of £40,000 a week, and that made him the highest paid player, would you believe, just a few years later. But one of the things that's interesting about that match is that Newcastle had some future Everton players playing for them. There's Steve Watson, who was usually used as fullback by Newcastle, but once scored a hat trick for Everton, believe it or not, playing as a kind of makeshift centre forward.
He used to do that relatively regularly in his career as well, Steve Watson. He was actually a very good footballer, Steve Watson. Not of the highest quality, but a really decent footballer.
Yeah, he was a kind of poor man's Paul Madeley in that he could play all around the pitch, but Madeley was a bit more of a Rolls Royce, whereas Steve Watson was a kind of Ford Sierra, if you like. But he was good. He was a solid pro. He was playing for Newcastle that day. There was also David Ginola, who later went on to play for Everton briefly. And of course, coming on as a substitute was the great Peter Beardsley, who later played for Everton as well. And Gary Speed was playing for Everton. He went the other way, along with Duncan Ferguson, who played for Newcastle, of course. And, you know, a touch of nostalgia for me, because Joe Parkinson was playing before an injury ended his career. I won't say Joe Parkinson was as good as Roy Keane, but he was a box-to-box midfield player, and he was a real hero for Evertonians. He came up through the ranks. He played, I think, at Wigan. You mentioned that, Lee, earlier on. And he was fantastic in Everton's Cup run in 95. And it was a kind of minor tragedy. Obviously, not the case for him personally, but it was a minor tragedy for Evertonians that his career did end just as it was likely to bloom into something really rather special. And I think it took Everton quite a while to come back from missing their dog of war in Joe Parkinson. Yeah. But he was a lot more than that. He was a lot more than just a destroyer. He was really, really a player.
He was actually from Wigan, a big Wigan Rugby League fan as well. He used to go and watch them regularly. I actually saw Everton this season, and that this literally just popped into my mind, and I did. I saw them lose at York City.
Yeah,
in the Coca-Cola Cup. Because my uncle was doing a post-doctorate at York, and I went to visit him, and we went to watch this game. And the travelling Everton fans, it was 3-2, York City 3, Everton 2. Gary Speed scored. He had a horrible game, Gary Speed. And I remember the Everton fans, as we were leaving, they were saying, oh, he's shite. And then somebody went, and you know, I can't do a Scouse accent very well, but said, yeah, but he supports us, doesn't he, lads? In that sarcastic way of saying, you know, well, we've signed him because he supports us. He's not actually very good, which is probably a bit unfair. But
do you want to hear the Everton side that night? Because
the York City night.
Yeah, we lost 3-2 to York City in September 96, so only a month or so after. Southall was in goal, Hottinger, Earl Barrett, David Unsworth, Andy Hinchcliffe, Andre Kanchelskis, Joe Parkinson, Gary Speed, Anders Limpar, Graham Stewart and Paul Rideout. There was no playing of squad players in those days. You know, every match was as important as the next match. So there are only 7,800 at Bootham Crescent, but there we were, turned over good and proper. A Graham Murty goal made it 3-1. Gary Speed got one back in the last minute.
You couldn't handle the magnificent giant plank of wood that was Neil, ex-Oldham Neil Tolson up front.
Yeah. evidently. So we were full of that kind of result really throughout the 90s were Everton. And maybe we're going to be full of it again with Silver in charge.
At least it's not Allardyce. Anything but Allardyce. Yeah.
We're going to get a few 3-2s and 3-1s before this season is out both ways, I feel.
So there you go, that's Everton. Derby had a humdinging match, Mike, against Leeds, a 3-3 thriller, of which there's a couple in this opening weekend. We've already mentioned that Wilkinson's still in charge. Yeah, go on, Mike.
Sorry, go on. Well, I mean, this is about as exciting as this season got for Leeds. So by the end of the season, they'd scored 27 goals in 38 Premier League games. So this game accounts for one ninth of their season total. So after Wilkinson departs, then George Graham and David O'Leary come in with Graham as the manager, and they somehow contrive to have 10 goalless draws in one season, which is like something you would see from Serie A in the like the mid 1980s or something. So it was I think the opening day was about as good as it got for them. But there's little signs of the shoots of Leeds' future recovery in this. I mean, Ian Hart scores. Lee Bowyer, who we've already mentioned, I think he gets the equaliser in this, doesn't he? Or he scores a goal that puts Leeds 3-2 ahead.
Yeah, he does. And then
Dean
Sturridge scores. Dean Sturridge is almost the perfect 1990s footballer in my mind. He's kind of small and nippy, and you thought he was quite good at the time, but he really wasn't very good, and he would never get anywhere near a Premier League now type player.
If he played 300 matches, he had the ball under control for 1 minute of those 300 yes. matches. Yes. It was forever just beyond his control. He was toe poking it in. He was chasing after it. But you could make a career. You know, he's the equivalent nowadays of kind of Dwight Gayle, I suppose. Although Dwight Gayle's a much more technically gifted player.
He's kind of like
a
road, really. He like meeped around the field, not looking quite in control, didn't he? Yeah, so we've mentioned Everton, Middlesbrough, and then the second 3-0, which is the most famous one, Middlesbrough 3, Liverpool 3, with a Ravanelli hat-trick on debut. Amazingly, when you look at this, Stig Ingebjornaby opened the scoring for Liverpool, right? And if you didn't pay much attention, he looked the way he moved and his finishing looked exactly like Robbie Fowler. You notice that in the highlights? I mean, obviously he's not. But if you just glance quickly, the way he kind of moves into the sort of left side of the penalty box and wangs it with his left foot into the far corner is very Robbie Fowler-esque, actually.
Yeah, 4 or 5 inches taller than Robbie Fowler, but I take the point.
But and Liverpool were in that horrendous Bailey's Irish Cream round neck kit had.
I don't think they'd learned anything from their white suits in the cup final a few months earlier. As a atrocious kit they played.
It's
in,
truly, but, truly atrocious. Yeah. John Barnes scores. Robbie Fowler scores as well. John Barnes, how old would John Barnes have been here? 34?
Mid to late 30s,
Still moved lovely. Did you? I mean, when you watched the highlights, though, did you see that all of the defending in this game is absolutely terrifyingly bad?
Oh, it's woke, wasn't it? Yeah.
It's almost like it's like there's three of you stood there and one guy just walked in between two of you and you've just not even bothered to look that he's there, or you don't even care, basically.
Yeah.
On both sides as well.
Talking, lads, talking.
yeah, exactly, yeah. looking. You're looking at the ball, I think, is what they were doing. And
they had some good players, Liverpool, up front, though, to be fair. They had Collymore and Fowler playing in that game.
Mark Wright was still playing.
Ghosted into the penalty box.
Mark Wright's still playing, looking about 50. Bjornaby. So, I mean, it was incredibly exciting and, in a way, was kind of emblematic of what this season and what the Premiership was at that time, wasn't it? All these signings coming in, Fowler coming through as a young player, this, like, what's seen as a fantastically exciting game, which, of course, it was. As I said, I was in Middlesbrough at the time, and Middlesbrough ended up getting relegated this year because they got docked 3 points for not going to play Blackburn, if you remember. I think it was Blackburn.
Yeah, they got to both cup finals as well, didn't they? They lost the League Cup final and the FA Cup. I mean, I think this was...
Was
I
that
think
the one
the
with Di Matteo's fastest ever goal? Was it 42 seconds or something in one of those games?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, Chelsea, Middlesbrough, the FA Cup final. Yeah. I mean, I think this 3-3 with Liverpool, Middlesbrough. I think it's undoubtedly the game of the day. I think from memory it was the league game on Match of the Day, and just the excitement around this at the time, because Middlesbrough, they're even being talked up as potential, you know, title challengers at this point, because they brought in, you know, Ravinelli and Emerson, and they already had Janino there, and they had Nick Barmby, and they had Brian Robson, who just had, you know, a very good summer, you know, managing the team with England. And then you had the Liverpool team that had gone pretty close the season before in the FA Cup and in the Premier League. And I think, yeah, Ravinelli hitting the ground like that straight away and scoring a hat-trick with just the giddiness in the ground. I mean, you can see it when the goals are all flying in. It's quite something. I also remember, do you remember Ravinelli used to do that celebration where he would peel back his shirt and put it over his head? Yeah. There was I remember a thing at the time that Cellnet were Middlesbrough sponsors, and they kicked up a real fuss about the fact that their logo wouldn't be seen every time Ravinelli scored. So at one point, they were trying to get Ravinelli to wear a vest underneath his shirt with the Cellnet logo on it. Just, I don't think that ever kind of came to fruition. But it was it's a fantastic game, just because of the sheer volume of errors in it from the defenders, just made it very exciting.
I think, Lee, you may know a bit more about this than I do. The reason why Middlesbrough didn't play that game, from my understanding, is that it was a flu epidemic going round.
Yeah, they basically said, we don't have the players, so we can't do it. Yeah, and that was their defence, and it wasn't listened to. And
Steve Gibson was going to come on and do a George Weir or something and kind of play. He was younger than some of the players, but I mean,
I don't think they were believed.
It was a genuine thing. Yeah, it was a genuine thing, though, and I felt they were harshly treated. I have to say, they were tapped on the head a bit as little Middlesbrough, and you know, you go off now with your 3-point penalty, and I'd be surprised if that were to happen today. But if it's going to happen to someone, it'll happen to a Middlesbrough, not to a Manchester City, not to a Manchester United. When was the 2 points and 1 point for Manchester United and Arsenal, the docking because they essentially had a Barney on the pitch? That was around...
That was 1990-91. And Arsenal still went on to win the league. I mean, he had Tottenham got docked 6 points for their financial irregularities, I think, in 94-95, but then they later got them reinstated, I think.
Yeah, I think Middlesbrough got the very rough end of the stick there. Really.
Well, I was, of course, up there. I remember Pat, who worked on reception, the student union, who was a Middlesbrough woman through and through, was basically forcing everybody that walked in to sign her petition, and woe betide anybody that didn't and defied her, because she was a terrifying northeast middle-aged woman of a particular type that you did not defy when you came walking in. And even when you'd signed it, you still had to kind of show her where you had signed it so she'd let you go, sort of.
Yeah, genuflect.
But I mean, it did get them. I mean, in theory, you know, if they'd had that 3 points, they wouldn't have been relegated on the pure numbers of it. So you could see why they were very, very upset. But after that sort of decent win, they lost to Chelsea. They had a draw with Forest. They won a few. But then they had a horrible, horrible run between September and December where they just couldn't win anywhere, basically. And then that kind of carried. They beat Everton, Gary.
Yeah.
On Boxing Day.
Yeah.
And then they just kept losing. So, I mean, that's team that they had. The trouble is, I think I go back, I made a joke before, for every Emerson, there was a Robbie Musto, there was a Neil Cox, there was a Nigel Pearson. He was solid enough, but not particularly great, you know.
Yeah, I think there's a kind of style of putting a team together. I mean, I don't play Championship Manager or any of those games, but it is like when you take a middling squad and then just parachute in a load of just massive names, three or four of them, and then they have to play with, you know, the kind of average players around them, kind of thing.
He was still playing Curtis Fleming at fullback and stuff, you know. Yeah.
It felt like some kind of control experiment, Middlesbrough.
That's a good way of putting it, yeah.
And a bizarre thing was that the most talented player in that side, the most technically gifted, was also the hardest worker in Juninho, who gave absolutely bloody everything for the cause there.
And he loved the Middlesbrough. He came back, didn't he, for a second spell, and he really loved the town and the club and the people, actually.
I bet when sort of the list of top 10 foreign signings of the 90s are put together. I bet he seldom appears in that top 10, but he certainly was one of the top 10 foreign signings of the 90s. And you know, had he played for a bigger club, maybe that would have been recognised. But he was you know, a really, really, really good player. He was Brazil's number 10. Mm. And he gave absolutely everything on
the
field.
It was jaw-dropping when he came over.
Yeah,
it was seriously, they must have been paying him so much and offering to pay his tax bill or something.
Well, they were talking of him as the new Zico, wasn't it? And he did have things in common with Zico, roughly the same build, same height, played number 10 for Brazil. He wasn't quite as good as Zico, but he was still good.
Hmm. So, yeah, so that carried on, and Liverpool kind of, well, Liverpool by the end of this season kind of stumbled through, didn't they?
They finished fourth at the end.
Yeah.
All right, yeah. Oh, no, didn't stumble through at all then. But, yeah, so... It was, again, if you want to have a bit more of a detail about that period, the Spice Boys period, episode 10 of season 1 is the place where you need to go and have a listen, because that covers that with, I think it's, I can't remember who's on that one, I think it's Rob and Scott Murray covers that one. Yeah, Rob's actually too busy. Rob's very busy writing a book, that's why he's not here for the first episode of this season, but he will be back. Right, so let's move on to the last sort of few fixtures before we draw this to a close. Sheffield Wednesday 2, Aston Villa 1. Notable for the appearance breaking through the wall of a certain young 19-year-old called Richie Humphreys. Born in Sheffield in November 1977, he came from a footballing family, Richie Humphreys. His grandfather, Ernest, played for Millwall, and his dad had trials for Sheffield United. He grew up Richie himself grew up a massive fan of the Blades and later joined their academy before being released by them at the age of 13, which must have been a bit heartbreaking for him. He went on to play for Sheffield Boys, where the Wednesday scouts were not going to pass him up in such a manner. And he joined their youth setup age 17 in 1995. After an impressive showing in pre-season, where he scored against AC Milan and Utrecht in a pre-season tournament, earning praise from Johan Cruyff, actually. He was selected for Wednesday's opening match due to injuries to David Hurst, there's a surprise, and Mark Bright. And this is where we find him today, scoring an absolute thunderbolt, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, this is the goal of this day, without question. I mean, I think it was clocked going in at 97 miles an hour.
Yeah, isn't it the fastest goal ever still or something in terms of the ball?
It's definitely up there, I think. It's always, when you see the list of them, it's always kind of in there. And it's, yeah, I mean, for anyone who hasn't seen it, I'd encourage you to YouTube this. It's sort of headed clear into the edge of the air, and he just takes it first time with his left foot, and he doesn't just put it past the keeper, he puts it in the top corner. And yeah, he was, I mean, I was particularly interested, I was born in November 1977 as well, so it's kind of, you know, it's just,
what could have been,
you know, in a parallel universe, what could have been. Yeah, but you mentioned the Cruyff thing at the get-go there. What Cruyff said about Richie Humphreys, I think he just mentioned the fact that he'd been impressed with him in this pre-season friendly. That then got mangled and found its way back to England as Richie Humphreys is the new Marco van Basten, says Johan Cruyff. And it's something that never
will left. Will we never learn? Hey, go on, yeah.
I mean, Richie Humphreys, other than Beckham, I don't think anyone really kind of surfed the wave of this, you know, huge surge of interest in English football after Euro 96 quite like Richie Humphreys did. So he scored again on Monday night football, I think 2 days later, and then he scored one of the goals of the season a few weeks after that against Leicester, where he does a meandering kind of 50-yard run and then chips the goalkeeper.
Yeah, he floats an absolutely beautiful chip, doesn't he, over the goalkeeper,
It's like Daley Atkinson's goal.
Yeah, and that contributes to Sheffield Wednesday won their first four games and were top of the league after four games. And this was going into like the naming of Glenn Hoddle's first England squad as well, and there's this whole, oh, is Richie Humphreys going to be in it? And he did, because of his age and everything, he kind of captured that, you know, the arrogance of youth, the exuberance of youth that would, you know, you saw in people like Robbie Fowler then as well. And you just thought, seeing him in those opening weeks of this season, well, he's going to have, you know, an amazing career. And he did have an amazing career, but, it, you know, it was a few runs lower.
That's a good point, actually, because, well, he then, it all tailed off quite quickly for him, really. One story goes that Chris Waddle was still at Wednesday then and was mentoring him, because both being left-footed players and all that kind of stuff, attacking players. But ironically, due to Humphreys's outstanding early form and Waddle's age, David Pleat then let Chris Waddle go And it's, you know, it's probably just one of those things where is it correlation or causation? But I suppose we'll never really know. But he seemed to kind of shrink a bit after Chris Waddle left the club.
Yeah, it's a strange one. I mean, you know, Chris Waddle, he's quite bitter about the end of his career, actually, if you ever hear him interviewed about it, that he kept getting moved on from club to club. And one of the reasons he said was behind this was that the managers that were taking him on loan and things were paranoid that he was there with a view to being, you know, player manager when results went south and being installed. So I think after this, he got to Falkirk, Chris Waddle, after this? I think he may have done. But yeah, I mean, Humphreys, I don't think he scored again in the Premier League after that chip against Leicester. He did go to the World Youth Championship with England, where they had a kind of reasonably good run. But from there, it's just one of those things. It never worked out for him. But, you know, because of the whole spotlight on the Premier League in those opening weeks straight after Euro 96, I mean, he's become sort of, I don't know, in a strange way, sort of an icon of that kind of, you know, mid-90s kind of era. There are a few players who had that kind of moment in the sun. They've done a couple of, you know, really famous things. Tony Yeboah, I think he scored 2 goals of the months back-to-back, didn't he? I remember Danny Cadamartri scoring in a derby for Everton, and then that became Danny Cadamartri's going to be the next big thing.
Was he in the same team as Michael Branch, Gary, Danny Cadamartri?
Well, I was going to mention, perhaps we should do a whole segment on the the great players who never became great, because just at Everton, you could pick Michael Branch, you could pick Danny Cadamartri, you could pick Francis Jeffers, the fox in the box.
Billy Kenny.
Billy Kenny. There were specific circumstances with Billy Kenny. Jack Rodwell. Yeah. But I think that it was a time again where it was a point where football clubs were not really managing all aspects of a player's career. The agents were really there to do the transfers. They weren't there to look after the players. And I think there were more players in the 80s and 90s who flashed and then slipped through the net than would ever be the case today. I mean, somebody's going to tell me that there are plenty today and we just don't see them because, you know, they're journeymen at Oldham and at MK Dons and stuff like
this.
Hey,
we've got Baxter now, speaking of Everton player.
That's it. And there's a few Ryan Ledsons I saw turning up in the Championship and so on. But there's a lot of talk about the likes of Phil Foden now, and, you know, he's not getting a game at Manchester City and when's he gonna come through? Because it's much more known and there's much more understanding of the asset value of a young player. I think they're looked after a bit, sometimes for cynical reasons, but sometimes for just decent human reasons. But back in the 80s and 90s, there were those who flashed briefly, like Richie Humphreys, and I remember that sort of hype around him as well. Went around the lower leagues essentially, and you kind of think, well, if you could do that at 19, you should really be able to do it at least that at 24. So what was going on? But, you know, maybe that's for a future time, Lee. We could put together a kind of flashes in hand, but that's a bit pejorative term. What I perhaps mean are those who, for one reason or another, didn't really
unrealized potential.
Yeah.
So, but to finish off on Humphreys, he did. He spent a few years there and had a slump he never really recovered from, really. Was sent on loan to Scunthorpe and Cardiff before a trial at Cambridge was cut short by injury. He then moved to Hartlepool, where he actually became a complete club legend, broke the appearances records, was part of their promotion push one year, and retired finally in 2017 after a couple of years at Chesterfield. And it goes back to your point, Mike, actually. He had a pretty bloody good career. I know it was in the lower leagues, but he was gainfully employed. You know, there's almost this thing that because he had this flash, I'm sure he'd prefer to stay in the Premier League, but he had this flash in the Premier League at 19, then everything else that comes after it is kind of valueless in the eyes of people, and it's just not the case, really.
Absolutely not the case. He was also a PFA guy, wasn't he?
He took over, he was chairman after, between sort of 2013 and 15, was he? Yeah. Can't remember who he took over from, but yeah. Yeah, well, so actually fair play to him.
Yeah, because of that kind of flush he had in those few weeks in the Premier League. I mean, there's always going to be that, oh, what might have been about him in the whole, you know, he's never going to escape that next Van Basten quote, even though it's obviously not true. But, you know, yeah, that shouldn't denigrate from, you know, the career he had at Hartlepool. It was obviously exceptional. And, you know, anyone in on this podcast and probably listening to it would swap what they're doing for the, the career that Richie Humphries'
career, yes.
Speaking as a man who 10 years ago was a member of the senior management team in a university and now Paul's Cage is around at Waitrose for a living, I have some empathy with you.
Sunderland-Leicester were next, 0-0 in front of 20,000 people. There's nothing to say about this match. It was absolutely diabolical.
Well, you mentioned Steve Guppy earlier. I always think he looks like Father Dougal from Father
bit.
Ted.
He does a bit,
and
yeah.
once had that lookalike printed at Football 365, and it did a lot of funny stuff. And unfortunately, the internet, as it does, has lost that, so it's gone forever.
Was Steve Guppy the original wing-back?
He was more of an authentic winger, I think, Steve Guppy. He didn't play that deep. You know, the wing back for me, you mentioned him earlier, a man well before his time, I thought, was Ian Hart. I thought Ian Hart, one could say Gary Stevens was a kind of a wing back. They were ostensibly fullbacks, but they were often ahead of the midfielders in the play. I thought Ian Hart was a fantastic player.
There were a lot of teams playing 3-5-2 then, actually. Liverpool played it. You know, Jason McAteer played at wing back for Liverpool through the mid 90s and was pretty good there.
Bjarnaby, you mentioned earlier, he was a wing back.
Well, they were all playing 3-5-2, so the wing back became that wide player, didn't they? In a 3-5-2, that was effectively what it was. Mel Sterland, there was a lad who got forward at Leeds. Right then we come on to Wimbledon 0, Man United 3. Cantona scores, Irwin scores, and David Beckham scores some goal, you may remember. Born in Leytonstone in 1975, David Beckham is David fucking Beckham. I don't need to tell you anything more about that. So this was, of course, the hello, my name's David Beckham shot, Mike.
I suppose it's the one that everyone goes back to as the arrival of Beckham. I mean, I think it goes back a bit further than that. In my eyes, I think the season before, the double winning season, 95-96, where Beckham had replaced Kanchelskis on the right, he had a really good season then as well. It kind of went under the radar with the return of Cantona and the heroics of Schmeichel and so forth. But this goal, it's often seen as the kind of changing of the guard moment for English football. The arrival of Beckham, and I think you mentioned the Spice Girls were at number one at the time as well. Obviously, they then became the big celebrity power couple, and but as English football was changing, Beckham becomes emblematic of that change and that shift to a celebrity. But the three goals in the game are all really good goals. I mean, Cantona's and Irwin's are both brilliant goals, but they're just overshadowed by the one in the last minute. And I think just before he got substituted, Cantona tried to beat Neil Sullivan from about 40 yards and shanked it a bit and it went wide. So I don't know if that was in Beckham's head when Beckham tried it as well. But whatever you think about, Beckham and his career and his celebrity obsession, it's a brilliant goal. I mean, I often thought for a long time that it went to the side of Sullivan. It didn't actually go over him. I think the camera angle is quite deceptive, but I think he does clear, and it's not a chip either. It's more of a drive.
No, he does. It's like a sort of, I don't know, like a 5-iron in golf, if you're going to use it like that. He kind of drives it, doesn't he? And should Sullivan have saved it, though? Should a decent keeper have got to it?
No. I feel quite strongly about this kind of thing because we want our keepers to be sweeper keepers these days. Even then, you had to be off your line. There were still some offside traps played and so on. And so there is always space above the keeper's head if you're good enough to find it. And while I'm always at the front of the queue to say that David Beckham was not the best English footballer of his generation. In fact, he wasn't the best Manchester United footballer. He wasn't the best Manchester United midfielder. And he wasn't the second best Manchester United midfielder at that time. He did strike a ball well. And there are players who do kick the middle of the ball particularly well, which allows them to do the kind of thing that Beckham did there. And I'm always surprised that more players don't do it. It was Charlie Adam used to try it a few times, didn't he? Because particularly in this age of the sweeper keeper, because even if you miss, and everybody laughs if you miss, it still puts the keeper that 5 yards further back from their starting position. So you gain 5 yards of space because the keeper has to be on the lookout for it. And I think it's a much underused tactic. And I know it's the last minute of the match and they're already winning and it's a bit of a Hail Mary, but it was a smart move by a smart player who maximized the gifts he had. And his main gift was striking the ball with that right foot. And it's a brilliantly conceived and brilliantly executed goal. And I'm surprised we don't have more of them, really.
Mm. Yeah, I don't think it should be underestimated how difficult a skill it is as well to strike a ball like that. I mean, it's often, there's a lot of revisionism with Beckham's career. And, you know, one of the criticism you always hear of him is that he could never beat a man. Was, well, how many people can, you know, cross a ball like David Beckham?
I mean, he didn't need to, did he? Yeah.
No.
Obsession with beating people if you don't need to do it.
Yeah, but I mean, those players in themselves, you know, dribblers who can go past people at will and, you know, put an end product on it, they're very, very rare. I mean, it's not like everyone but Beckham.
You know, he could beat a man, Danielson.
Yeah.
Would you rather have him in your team or David Beckham? Take your pick.
But, yeah, I mean, and this goal on that day, I mean, how many times have we seen that now? It's that was his career off and running. I think he scored on at Derby a few weeks later as well, which was just before Hoddle announced his England squad. And Darren Anderton, who was playing on the right for England, was injured. And then he subsequently
sat
the whole season. Yeah. So that spot opened up on the right for Beckham in the England team, and he was straight in, and then he never budged for 10 years, basically. It's just the kind of, you know, the stars aligned for him or whatever you want to say. And
well, yeah, he had to budge when he got sent off, but I know what you mean.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Gary, with your contrary views. Final game and the final bit of the pod. Southampton played Chelsea on the Sunday, I believe. And there's a link back to the Beckham thing, isn't there, Mike?
Yeah, so I think so. This game took place on the Sunday, so everyone would have seen Match of the Day and Beckham's goal by this point. And LeBerf has a Yahoo at a 50-yard lob of I can't remember who was in goal for Southampton at that point. It wouldn't have been Dave Besson, would it? I can't remember.
It was Besson. It was Dave Besson. Yeah.
Was it? Oh yeah, but and he just shanks it terribly wide. But there was a lot of focus on Chelsea. I mean, it was the first live game of the season on Sky. Howitt had just taken over from Hoddle as the manager, would go on to win the FA Cup that season as well. And then in that little period at the end of the 90s, so from with Howitt and then when Vialli took over afterwards, they won 5 cups, Chelsea, of, you know, varying descriptions. I mean, a lot of people think that Chelsea's establishment as a English and European force just, you know, fell out of the sky after Abramovich started putting his money in. But from this point on, they became a serious team, Chelsea. They had Roberto Di Matteo, who they signed for a lot of money, LeBerf, and obviously, you know, Vialli as well went into the team up front. He just won a European Cup with Juventus. I mean, you could really see from there that, you know, I think Chelsea were, going about things a different way.
Yeah. Was this around the time that Chelsea became the first team to field a starting 11, none of whom were British? But I mean, Dennis Wise was usually in that first choice, wasn't he? But if it wasn't this season, it wasn't long after. And, you know, there's mention, I think, on the highlights of Chelsea's foreign legion, and there was a lot of talk about how many of the players were foreign born playing for Chelsea. Because it's amazing looking at those highlights, just how many British names you get, and you get the sort of, you know, the blandness of a Steve Jones playing for West Ham. And of course, you know, those players are still there now, but the foreign players still stood out in those days. Teams had one or two, but Chelsea certainly had more than most, for sure.
Yeah, well, I think Chelsea started with John Spencer up front that day, but and I think it was in 97, 98 that they fielded a team of 11 non-English players. And there was always a certain
non-British, I think, Michael.
Non-British, was it? Sorry.
Hughes. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, yeah, but there was always a kind of... Yeah, it was referred to with a kind of sense of distaste. I mean, you can even see it on the highlights clips that we kind of looked at before we did this show, that it was viewed with, you know, a bit of suspicion that, you know, Chelsea would have this many overseas players kind of playing for them. But and, you know, that's, I guess, down to that stereotypical British distrust of the foreigner. There's actually quite a funny quip on it from the news announcer where he says Southampton, they have an overseas star of their own, he's from Guernsey, in reference to Matt Letizia.
This is the most one-sided 0-0 you'll ever see, by the way. Chelsea should have won this game about 8-0.
Oh, blimey, yeah.
I don't think, actually in the highlights package, I don't think Southampton get into Chelsea's half at any time. It's incredible. That was a 0-0 win for Southampton. It was amazing. So there you go. That's a rundown of the 1996-97 weekend of fixtures. We are just going to do these types of episodes. We will be doing the more long featured sort of subject episodes as well this series. But we'll also be doing this where we dip into some weekends of fixtures. By all means, get in touch with us and tell us if there's any particular weekend of fixtures you think we should be focusing on, and we'll consider that. It all depends on what we can get on YouTube, quite frankly. So because while we remember some bits, we don't remember everything. So just leaves for me to say thank you very much for tuning in, and it's goodbye from me, goodbye from you, Gary.
Yes, goodbye. I look forward to being back on again soon,
and see you soon, Mike.
Bye, see you again soon. Thanks,
take care, everybody.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Fluffy bread, fresh tortillas, classic burger buns, and so many carbs. Carb fear is real, but Hero Bread makes healthier versions of the carb-heavy favorites we love most. We're talking fewer calories, 0 to 2 grams net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and seriously, great taste. Made from a new recipe using heart-healthy olive oil and resistant wheat starch that acts as a prebiotic fiber to promote gut health, Hero Bread products have more of the dietary fiber and protein you want without the net carbs and sugar you don't. There's something for every craving. Sliced bread loaves, buns, and tortillas, plus monthly small batch drops of indulgent favorites with no compromise. Like the 2-gram net carb Hero croissant or the 1-gram net carb Hero cheddar biscuit. Don't skip out on your favorites. Just use Hero Bread. Get 10% off your order at hero.co with code HEROPOD at checkout. That's HEROPOD at HERO.CO.